outside. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware the savage shore of 1984. Oh, see, come see, remember me.
Lay down all night, moving round. You said it would last, but I guess we grow in 1984.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lewis Beale, who writes about culture and film for the Los Angeles Times, Newsday, USA Weekend, and the New York Times. In 1986, Lewis started at the LA Daily News as a film reporter, went on to write for the Detroit Free Press, and then to the New York Daily News. He's lectured in the Department of Film and Media Studies at Hunter College and also taught at the University of North Carolina. He has an article at CNN, We're Living 1984 Today. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lewis Beale.
Thanks for having me.
And apparently there's been an enormous spike in the sales of George Orwell's book, which was written in 1948, 1984, since the Snowden revelations. What's happening?
I think maybe a lot of people made the connection between the all-encompassing surveillance state in 1984 and the surveillance state that we're living under here in 2013. There are parallels. They're not exactly the same because, of course, 1984 is a much more rigid and totalitarian society than we have today. But I think the parallels in terms of, you know, what the NSA is available, what it can do, what kinds of things are being looked at over our shoulder, security cameras, all that kind of thing, I think there's a lot of different parallels in that respect. And people are sort of, you know, sparking to that.
Well, apparently the sales have gone up, according to Amazon, up 9,000% of 1984.
Well, I don't think they were, like, you know, in the top 25 to begin with, but there's obviously been a huge spike in terms of whatever their sales were because people have recognized that there are parallels here, and they want to find out exactly how prescient Orwell was. And in a lot of cases, he was, not just in the security aspects, but other things involved in the novel that have a relevance to today.
Well, of course, 1984 and Animal Farm as well were clearly based upon Stalin's Russia. And Orwell himself had fought in the Spanish Civil War with the anarchists, who were betrayed by Stalin and were, in fact, they had a harder time with Stalin's secret police than they did fighting Franco. So he was quite bitter about that experience. So how come it's sort of, have we become Stalinist Russia, Stalinist Soviet Union?
We're definitely not the Stalinist Soviet Union, but I think that there are a lot of parallels in terms of, for example, he talks about telescreens, which are in everybody's house, which can monitor people's activity 24/7. We don't have telescreens in our houses, but basically our activities can be monitored through our computers now. Anybody can hack into it, or smart people can hack into our computers and find out everything we're doing. People are storing data and finding out what our data is, things like that. So I think in a way the computer is sort of the modern telescreen. He talks about surveillance. I mean, the number of surveillance cameras that we see in our society today is just overwhelming. In your native land, Great Britain, I think, has the most surveillance cameras of any country in the world. You know, people say this is a good thing. It helps us catch criminals and stuff like that. But it also, you know, is a way to surveil any human being for any reason whatsoever. Those are the kinds of things I think that people are concerned about and see in the book that, you know, are relevant to today.
Well, a lot of the information that comes via our computers is voluntarily scooped up by Google and Facebook. I mean, people relinquish that information whether they know it or not, and nobody seems to be particularly bothered by the extent to which Google and Facebook are building tremendous profiles on each and every individual who uses their service. And, you know, people are upset that the government is spying on them, but seem less upset that private entities are spying on them.
Yeah, I think that we've sort of gone down the road so far that in a way there's no turning back, and people, I think in a way maybe people feel powerless about this kind of stuff. Unless you're living in a cabin in the woods someplace, totally off the grid, there's no way that you're not going to come to the attention of either some corporate entity or some government entity. I mean, that's just the world we live in today, and I think it's pretty unfortunate, but that's, you know, that's the reality of today's world.
And again, I'm speaking with Lewis Beale, who writes about culture and film for the Los Angeles Times, Newsday, USA Weekend, and the New York Times. In 1986, Lewis started at the LA Daily News as a film reporter and then went on to write for the Detroit Free Press and then for the New York Daily News. He has lectured in the Department of Film and Media Studies at Hunter College and also taught at the University of North Carolina. And he has an article at CNN, We're Living 1984 Today. Well, one of the real parallels, it seems to me, to 1984 is the idea that Orwell was, of course, talking about the Cold War in the sense that the Cold War was rigged, it was circumscribed, that the best deal that the Soviets offered their people and that the Americans offered their people was that in 20 minutes you'll be dead and then 20 minutes later the Russians will be dead or vice versa. And through this paralysis, both sides were able to essentially wage war on each other's populations by keeping them under control and taxing them enormously to build these massive military machines that could only promise them complete annihilation and not victory. So that was the context for 1984 that he talked about, Orwell talked about the endless war. We certainly have an endless war today. That is the war on terror.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. And I think in a way that the psychology is pretty much the same. It's like, well, not exactly the same, because at least in the Cold War, there was an identifiable enemy, and it was supposedly the Soviet Union and the countries behind the Iron Curtain. Now the enemy, I think, shifts a little bit. Is it Islam? Is it Al-Qaeda, which represents a branch of Islam? Is it a certain country? Is it this? Is it that? But it's also just a war that our president just even said, who knows when this is going to end, if it ever is going to end. And I think that's one of the things in the book, that there is this endless war between three different countries and the alliances keep shifting. And in a way, nobody really knows who they're fighting, because the whole object of the government is to keep people terrified and paranoid so that they can control them. I think that certainly is part of what's happening today with the war on terror, is that, you know, we've given up certain of our liberties through things like the Patriot Act because we think that there's this war going on and we can't identify the enemy. The enemy could be anybody, could be some 19-year-old kid from Boston who looks just like us, supposedly. And I think that's one of the things that makes 1984 so relevant to today, about this endless war and who is it that we're fighting.
You talk about the enemy. The enemy could be us, according to the revelations from Edward Snowden about this prison program, which were then just as testimony last week before the Senate. The Director of National Intelligence released information about this same program, and there was a very close vote in the House to try and shut it down. And the point is that what the program does is it scoops up everybody's metadata and who they communicate with. And then there's another secret program that's also been revealed that indicates they do even more via the internet in terms of finding out about you and what you read, think, who you talk to, etc. So the point is that this would indicate that the enemy is us. If all of us are being monitored by the government thinks we're all potential enemies.
Well, I think that's basically true. I mean, I think of this surveillance is so broad-based. Basically, the government is saying we're all suspects and suspected of something. And that's, I think, one of the scariest things about what's going on, is that they can use this information in any way they want against anybody at any time. And that's pretty scary.
So let's turn to Orwell's doublethink, which quite often I find myself using the term Orwellian when I'm trying to analyze the news on a daily basis, where so much of it does feel Orwellian. Give us a sense of why you think that doublethink is alive and well today, Lewis Beale.
Well, let me give you two examples if I can. One of them, I think, is what's going on with some of the abortion laws that are being passed around the country today. Basically, the people who are passing these laws are saying that we're doing this to improve women's health. But essentially what they're doing is creating an atmosphere in which abortion clinics are so restricted and managed that they are forced to close down because they can't keep up with all these laws. And therefore, women are not only being denied abortions, but they're being denied essential health care. So essentially the doublethink here is that, oh, we're helping women's health by doing this, but basically we're also closing down clinics, so that's going to hurt women's health. I think the same thing is occurring with a lot of these ID voting laws that are going on. And it's not just about voting ID. I live in North Carolina, and we just recently passed a law that's not just about voting ID, but cut back on early voting, cut back on how much time polls can be open and things like that. And everyone, the people who are passing these laws, saying, oh, we're just doing this to, you know, make the process easier. But what they're doing is essentially making it so that fewer people can vote. And I think that's the double think here. It's that, oh, this is going to make the process easier, but basically it's all about, you know, not making it easy for people to vote. And that's double think.
And what about Newspeak?
you know, I think it's, you know, in the book it's supposed to be a reductionist language that makes it so that you can't have a really thorough thought, to strip down and limiting free speech. In a way, I think texting is that, although texting is, in a way, kind of benevolent speech or not nasty speech. I mean, when we go, oh, my, OMG or LMAO, it's just, it's a stripped-down thing. But I think what this shows is a certain way of which speaking can be reduced to its most basic elements, and that means also its most basic thought, so there's no real deep thought here. Newspeak was a government program in 1984, and the sort of, you know, Newspeak that we have today is not really a government program, but it's still a way that thought is stripped down to its bare essence, and people aren't really saying a hell of a lot.
Well, they're not saying a hell of a lot, and they may actually, it may lead to greater illiteracy, isn't it? Because kids use their computers now to do their arithmetic, so they don't learn math like they used to. And presumably, eventually, English will be corrupted by this shorthand version, won't it?
I think that's probably true, although I'm not so much of a pessimist about that. I think that basically people are still reading books, and people are still, they still have to read real sentences on their computers. I'm not as worried about that as I am about other things, you know, the comparisons.
Well, they're clearly reading 1984, so that
that's true.
That's a
but
good.
If I may, I'd like to bring up one that I find really fascinating because when I was doing research for this piece, I came across a website from a Baptist church, and I forgot what state. And I found it fascinating because there was a page from the youth group at this church that said, "Come join the cool kids. Come join the anti-sex league." And this was a bunch of kids who were encouraging abstinence only. But what I thought was fascinating was I wondered if these kids even knew the origin of the anti-sex league and what it meant. And because in 1984, the anti-sex league is an organization that is meant to reduce sex, reduce the pleasure from sex, and make it solely for procreation. And I think these kids using that term, there's kind of an irony to that, that I just found fascinating. Do they really understand what they're talking about?
Well, but abstinence is something that's been promoted for a long time, hasn't it?
It has, but I mean, but to use the phrase, join the anti-sex league, I just thought, wow, I wonder if these kids really, if they've read 1984, if they understand the origins of that term, because it's not really about abstinence, it's about making sex, you know, not pleasurable.
Well, I don't know how much that is, in effect, the policy of the Catholic hierarchy in the Vatican. You know, abstinence and ban on birth control and, of course, on abortion. The excuse being that sex is supposed to be about procreation and not about pleasure, and that if it is about pleasure, then it's a sin.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. And that's, and Orwell was reacting to that, too.
Well, of course, under Stalin, the Soviets were quite puritanical as well.
Yeah, and I think, again, like you said, a lot of the book is basically a reaction to Stalinism and what was going on, because the book also contains show trials, which occurred under Stalin with great frequency. I think, in a sense, you could say that if Bradley Manning's was a show trial. You could say that if Edward Snowden is put on trial in this country, it's going to be kind of a show trial, that the conclusion is foregone, you know, that the state is making a statement by putting these people on trial for what they're doing. You know, so I think there's that, you know, comparison also.
Well, but that's the fear that I have, is that as this paranoia, and in particular if there's another terrorist attack in this country, now, you know, there's this latest terrorist alert that's out worldwide, But if what we've seen recently and what we've learned from Snowden's revelations and from what the government's admitted to and what some of the members of the Senate, a couple of the better senators seem to care more about the American people than about the national security state, hinting that there's a lot worse out there. We had an experience, you know, we talk about Stalinism. The United States imitated Stalinism during the House of Un-American activities in the 40s and 50s, all the way through the 1960s. And that was the idea of show trials. You know, they had show trials here in Hollywood. You know, are you or are you not a communist? That was the same question that the Stalin show trials ask. So we created our own nemesis and imitated our enemy. And it seems in many ways that what's happening to us now is a mirror of that, where it's us and them, you know, you're either with the terrorists or against the terrorists, etc. And we're not too far from that. And you're right about these show trials, Bradley Manning, and if they ever get their hands on Snowden, I'm sure it'll be the same thing.
You know, I also remember when I was a kid, we used to have these nuclear bomb drills. Which were absolutely worthless, because if a bomb were dropped, whatever they had us do, which was hide under desks and things like that, wouldn't have made any difference at all. But what it did is it instilled this kind of free floating fear in everyone in the country that this could happen any time. I think the same thing is going on here. There's this endless stream of paranoia coming out of the government that makes everybody paranoid about what can happen, and even though the acts of terrorism in this country have been really limited. There have been very few. People are really concerned about these things. And I don't know, I think it's the same thing. There's just this free-floating aura of paranoia that the government is using to keep people afraid, you know, and that keeps them passive at the same time.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Lewis Beale.
Sure, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Lewis Beale, who writes about culture and film for the Los Angeles Times, Newsday, USA Weekend, and the New York Times. In 1986, Lewis started at the LA Daily News as a film reporter and then went on to write for the Detroit Free Press and then the New York Daily News. He's lectured in the Department of Film and Media Studies at Hunter College and also taught at the University of North Carolina. He has an article at CNN, We're Living 1984 Today. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back, joined in the studio by media critic Toby Miller.